alcohol so different? We're often hesitant to tell our friends. You might be a little hesitant to tell even your friends, and I believe there's a pretty good reason for that. I think the crux of the problem is that we treat alcohol differently than we do any other addictive substance. For example, we don't have cigarette-aholics or heroinism, but we do have alcoholics and alcoholism. When we say cigarette addiction or heroin addiction, we're talking about the addiction, not the person themselves. But the word alcoholic defines a person. The word itself blames the person rather than the substance. And for some reason in our culture, a heroin addict is someone to be pitied because they've been overpowered by an addictive substance. But an alcoholic is someone who is weak and unable to control themselves around something as innocent as a glass of beer. And it's no wonder we do this. According to certain statistics, 86% of people over 18 have drank alcohol at some point. That's a huge number. And I think the only way we can justify to ourselves that so many people drink is to simply not talk about the fact that alcohol is addictive, just like heroin and tobacco are. In fact, as a society, we don't seem to even realize that alcohol is addictive. We don't talk about the fact that when we're at a party on Friday night and we end up puking, that the physical reaction is our body's way of saving our life because we literally poisoned ourselves. And so the language that's developed around alcohol and the attitude of blaming the person instead of the substance has created this huge taboo against talking about it at all. We treat every other substance that's bad for us differently than we treat alcohol. I might be chatting with my friend in front of a big box of donuts and say, this is a great donut, but I'm only going to have half of one because I know all the fat and sugar is bad for me. But what if the entire conversation changed? What if the question about drinking a bit less became a wellness conversation, like stopping smoking or eating less sugar? What if we could talk about alcohol in the same way we talk about eating a few less donuts? Can you imagine what our society might look like if there was no stigma, no fear of the label alcoholic, and we could truly have a wellness conversation around our drinking? I know I would have looked at my drinking much earlier, certainly before it became truly a problem if alcohol were not such a loaded topic. And the great news? Just by participating in the alcohol experiment, you are part of that global movement to do just that, to look at our drinking well before the point of disaster. That's amazing, and I am so proud of us. But nobody ever says, this is a great Chardonnay, but I'm just going to have one glass because I worry about breast cancer and liver damage. That doesn't happen. We have successfully separated alcohol out from other toxic substances. We even say alcohol and drugs, as if alcohol weren't also a drug, in spite of the fact that alcohol kills more people every year than all prescription and all illegal drugs combined. In fact, according to two independent studies about what is the most dangerous drug, alcohol won the prize in both. So I think this societal attitude is why people treat you differently than when you quit smoking or when you cut down on sugar. Because when you tell your friend that you're not drinking, there's an automatic implied judgment. Because that friend probably feels like they drink about the same amount as you. And if you think you're drinking too much, then you must also think they are drinking too much. Whether that's true or not doesn't matter. And guess what? They probably have some internal conflict around their own drinking. So the fact that you're not drinking actually becomes painful for them. Perspective change. When I was drinking a lot, I couldn't comprehend why anyone would choose not to drink. Why on earth not? What was the big deal? It didn't make sense to me. Looking back on those days now, I can see that deep down inside, I knew I was treating my body badly. And when I was confronted with friends who'd make the decision to stop treating their bodies badly, it made me feel like they were strong and I was weak. And I didn't like that. And there is another reason your friends may try and sabotage your efforts. They don't want to lose you. One of the most fundamental parts of being human is that we crave community and interaction with other people. And we've given alcohol this magical power to make us all into fun-loving, laid-back party animals. I thought that without alcohol, I wouldn't be any fun. I believed that alcohol was the glue that held my friendships together. So when I decided alcohol no longer had a place in my life, it set me apart, and we don't like as humans to be set apart. So your friends may feel like you will ostracize them or you won't want to spend time with them anymore. And of course, nobody wants that. Or is it fear? Are they afraid of their own drinking? If your friends aren't being supportive, realize that it is probably out of fear. They're actually afraid you're judging them. Deep down, they know that maybe they shouldn't want to drink as much as they do. They may be afraid you won't want to spend time with them anymore. And they may be afraid that they might be an alcoholic. When people question their drinking, they might actually be wondering, am I an alcoholic? And of course, the implications of that question seem horrific. Alcoholism has been defined as a lifelong disease for which there is no cure. Alcoholics must completely abstain from drinking forever. They have to label themselves as alcoholics for the rest of their lives, even if they manage to stay sober. Alcoholism is portrayed as a never-ending fight for control. A fight that, if people lose, could cost them their marriage, their job, their children, or even their life. That is so scary. No one wants to think about all that when all they're trying to do is unwind after a long day at work. So today, plan how you can bring up the subject with those close to you, so that you can keep your fun, friendly relationship with them. Here are a few ideas of how to talk to your friends without alienating them. You can keep it light and joking. Say something like, I'm overdoing it on iced tea, ha ha. Or you can be self-deprecating, but not too much because you're doing an amazing thing and you honestly don't need to be apologetic. You could say something like, I drank enough last month to last for the next 30 days, so I'm just taking a break. Or you could let it lie. The truth is, the less you make of it, the less they will make of it. Sometimes we assume people are judging our behaviors, when in reality, people are mostly thinking about themselves. If you shrug it off like it's no big deal, chances are they will also. I love to simply say, I'm good, thanks. By the way, I've been meaning to ask you, how have you been lately? What's new in your life? This not only turns down a drink, but often kicks off a great conversation. Day 7, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Telling your friends and family. Jot down some ideas about how to talk to your friends and family about the alcohol experiment. Write down anything that comes to mind. Then use what feels best when you have conversation with your friends and family. If you've already had these conversations, write down what worked and reflect on what didn't. Sometimes these conversations take trial and error, and that's okay. 2. Drinking as a wellness conversation instead of an addiction conversation. Reflect on the reading. How does it make you feel to think of drinking less as a wellness conversation instead of an addiction conversation? What would it be like if taking a break from drinking were celebrated in the same way as somebody stopping smoking cigarettes? What do you think about the fact that society treats alcohol differently than other drugs? Take a moment to feel proud that by taking part in this experiment, you are part of the movement to make the question around drinking an easier one for anyone to ask. Day 7 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Matthew says, I can't believe I'm here at day 7, feeling more positive and having more belief and confidence in myself. You don't realize what alcohol steals from you until you start to get it back. Stay strong, everyone. Tommy says, it doesn't matter what others think of my not drinking, this is my journey. But socially, I'm actually more comfortable now. Knowing I had a problem and just rode along enjoying the buzz but not paying attention to what I was doing to my body really makes me sad. But on the other hand, it keeps me alcohol-free knowing I can't just have one because that would start all over again. It's quite freeing to put this addiction behind me and cut the ties that alcohol once had on me. And Zoe says, I'm loving this. Thank you so much, Annie, for the resource. So far, I'm on day 7 and it's been pretty easy. I think when you're changing your mind about something, you have to mentally ingest as much supportive information as possible. As for the reasons I give people I don't know very well or feel like I might be judged by, I prefer to say that alcohol was making me depressed, so I decided to stop to feel better. It's definitely the truth. And no one can argue that alcohol isn't a depressant. This way, I feel empowered instead of disempowered by my choice. I don't choose to be labeled as an addict or an alcoholic. If I had to find another reason to give people to remain neutral and free from judgment, I would just say that alcohol was making me feel sick. And it didn't agree with my body, and that's definitely the truth. Day 8. How alcohol affects your senses. Immanuel Kant said, "All our knowledge begins with the senses." Your 5 senses are how your brain collects information about what's going on inside and outside your body. If there's a fire nearby, your brain needs to be able to smell the smoke, feel the heat, and hear the crackle to make decisions. It also needs to see the fire to sort out whether you've got a dangerous threat, like a nearby explosion, or whether you're enjoying a nice relaxing campfire. Your senses are amazing tools. So what happens to those tools when we drink? They're dulled and they become much less effective communicators. Worse, our brains process the information more slowly. It's kind of like a video that takes forever to buffer and play on your computer. There's a lag. It might be inconvenient and cause you to say something embarrassing, or that lag might be deadly and cause you to drive your car into oncoming traffic. Unfortunately, there's no way to know how bad the lag is until it's too late. What happens in the brain? Alcohol depresses the central nervous system and slows down your neurotransmitters, which are the chemicals responsible for moving information back and forth between your body and your brain. When your brain can't process the information as quickly as usual, your senses are affected. They're sitting there staring at that buffer bar saying, "Come on, come on, why is this taking so long?" You know how sometimes a video never fully loads on your computer? Well, your brain can do that too. That's when you pass out or black out. But before you get to that stage, you'll notice your senses dulling. Blurred vision, slurred speech, numbness in your fingers and toes. Sound familiar? Have you ever wondered why people talk louder when they're drunk? It's because their sense of hearing has been impaired. And even your sense of touch is affected, as your ability to perceive pain decreases. Now, that may seem like a good thing if you have chronic back pain, but it's not so great when you fall down and break your arm, but you can't even feel it until you've done more damage. An early warning system. Our senses keep us safe. They alert us to big dangers, but also give us smaller hints when something doesn't feel quite right. In addition to being an early warning system, they also help us experience pleasure and happiness. Did you know that one of the most arousing scents for men is pumpkin pie? Seriously, it's an aphrodisiac, which may or may not explain the popularity of pumpkin spice lattes. And memories, they're one of life's most precious gifts. And our memories are also connected to our senses. When we drink, we're dulling those senses of pleasure and robbing ourselves of wonderful, happy experiences. And we're robbing ourselves of the memories we should be storing. One of the reasons you don't remember the party last night is because you didn't get that sensual information stored away. Your senses were too dull and slow to store away the experience of laughing and joking with your friends, or that first kiss you've been waiting for. Is it worth not remembering your child's birthday party because you had a few too many glasses of wine to get through it? One of my biggest regrets is my son's 3rd birthday party. We had this incredible party, and even looking at the photos, I can't remember it. I had made sangria early in the day and drank quite a bit of it, and no matter how hard I try to remember anything, that day is gone. The funny thing is that no one there could even tell how much I was drinking, but the memories are just not there. And to this day, it breaks my heart that I missed such an important day. When I think about how many things I've missed that I don't even know I've missed because they weren't as evident as that birthday party, I realize just how much alcohol has stolen from me. And too often we take our senses for granted and don't realize how much we'd miss them if they went away. Keeping your senses sharp not only keeps you safe, but it also helps you enjoy life's experiences more and remember them later. So today, take some time to focus on each sense individually. Look around you. What do you see that's beautiful? The smile on your spouse's face? The trees? The sky? And appreciate the fact that you can hear the birds and the ocean, as well as the oncoming traffic. How does the coffee smell this morning? And the fresh baked bread you had with lunch, how did it taste? Run your hands through the grass. How does it feel? Prickly or soft and lush? Your senses are what make you feel alive. We must treat them with respect. Day 8, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Your incredible senses. Think about your senses. Can you imagine what it would be like if you lost even one? Consider and journal about each sense and the impact that alcohol has on each. Blurring your vision, numbing your taste buds, impacting your sense of smell and hearing, and diminishing your ability to feel? Our senses are how we experience life. Have you taken them for granted? Reflect on this. 2. Is it worth it? Understanding the impact alcohol has on our senses, ask yourself why you may have wanted to diminish them or your experience of life. And be honest, there's no wrong answer. Just a reflection for you and your journey. Day 8 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Pamela says, this lesson reminds me of something my yoga teacher once said, that a body in balance craves what will keep it in balance, whereas a body out of balance will crave what will keep it out of balance. I never thought to apply this to alcohol before. I'm so amazed at how I could convince myself that drinking was no big deal while at the same time knowing that I needed to quit. And now I see how it has contributed to my lifelong low-grade depression, something I thought I was born with and I just have to live with. For the first time in my adult life, I'm hopeful that I will finally know what it's like to live with joy. And I've been seeing glimpses of that since I quit the sauce, and I like it. Francis says, I'm learning so much from this experiment. Right now I can't even imagine putting alcohol into my body again. I can see how it dulled my senses and caused me so much grief and anxiety. I found myself looking back at all the things I missed by not being fully present and the mistakes I made due to alcohol. I'm trying not to dwell on the mistakes, but use them as a catalyst to move forward. Bill says, I feel so alive. I was suffering from slight depression, but never went to the doctor for any medication. Now I realize that the slight depressive feeling I was having every day was simply the effects of alcohol. I don't have it anymore, and everything seems sharper and crisper. Coffee smells better, tastes better, and gives me that clean energy in the morning that I could never quite reach after a night of drinking. Also, I don't lie awake and worry about my children, money, my health, etc. Everything I wanted alcohol to give me, sobriety has given me. Day 9. The power of self-talk. Gary Hensel said, I am. Two of the most powerful words, for what you put after them shapes your reality. If you've ever tried to make a change in your life or start a new habit, you know how easily negative thinking and self-talk can defeat even your best intentions. You can start the day strong and full of optimism, but as the day wears on, the voice inside your head can get louder and more insistent until it becomes easier just to give in. Sometimes it can feel like there's a constant loop of negativity playing in your head, over and over, louder and louder. It's possible you've been experiencing this your whole life in lots of different ways. The good news is that you can change it. The better news is that it's not difficult, though it might take some time and practice. Awareness is key. Let's talk about becoming aware of your self-talk. Recognizing what you're telling yourself is the first step. And one way to become deeply aware of how you're talking to yourself is to imagine that voice inside your head that's chattering it up is actually another person. Imagine they're sitting in the chair next to you, and just listen objectively. Let them chatter on for a while. Would you ever let a real person talk to you like that? Would you sit and listen to all those negative stories? And would you humor them as they went on and on and on? Of course not. You would never in a million years let somebody sit next to you and never shut up about everything that's wrong with you. Once you personify that voice in your head as an actual individual, you realize how intense and incessant it is. Simply by becoming aware of this self-talk, you have unlocked the door to changing it. Research shows that most of our thinking is recycled from the day before. In fact, up to 80% of your thoughts from today were probably also the thoughts you had yesterday. We often give in to what our inner voice is saying simply because it's so repetitious. And repetition masks itself as truth. When something becomes familiar to us, like a thought pattern, we believe it because it's familiar. That's exactly how advertising works. The more often you see an ad on TV or in a magazine, the more likely you are to believe its claims. So whatever you're telling yourself over and over again, eventually you're going to start believing it, even if it's blatantly untrue. Self-talk and cravings. During this experiment, you might be doing a lot of self-talk. I actually want you to recognize two different types. You have the self-talk that is conniving, that will do anything to convince you to pick up a drink. This type of self-talk involves both justifications and comparisons. We'll repeatedly tell ourselves that we need the alcohol, that we won't be okay without it, that we won't be able to sleep without it, and that just one won't hurt. It's also easy to justify our own drinking when we compare our behavior to other people's. If you're a regular drinker, you might say, well, at least I'm never a fall-down drunk. Or at least I'm not as bad as so-and-so. And if you're a binge drinker, you might say, well, at least I don't drink every night. Notice if you're making these types of comparisons. Some other self-talk you might be hearing in your head includes things such as, this is too hard. This has already been too difficult. I'm not going to be successful, so I might as well give up now. All of these things are just stories that you tell yourself. And because you repeat them so often, you don't even hear them anymore. You just accept them as true. So you have to stop and hear them again by becoming aware of what you're telling yourself. That way you can make a conscious decision about whether they're actually true. Some people who have been through this process actually find it helpful to personify this repetitive voice. They'll call it the wine witch or the alcohol monster. When you see the voice as something that's not you, it's much easier to see through its manipulation. And it's not really you. So here's how to recognize that the voice is not really you. It tells repetitive stories. And it has a single aim, to get you to drink. And it's one-sided, and it's manipulative. You are stronger than the voice. And it will quickly weaken when you recognize it for what it is and put some distance between you and it. Give it some space. It's very noisy, and I get that, but its bark is worse than its bite. It has no actual power over you. It's that little child in the backseat of the car who's desperate for an ice cream. She's not going to give in easily, but ultimately, you are in charge. Self-talk and self-worth. The other type of self-talk, which is possibly more insidious, is the constant negative dialogue we have in our own minds toward ourselves. This is when we beat ourselves up and are harder on ourselves than we would ever be on another human. Here's the thing. You did not create yourself. Think about that for a minute. You are here. You are breathing. But you did not choose to be here breathing. You didn't create your beating heart or your hair color or anything else about you. And because of that, I believe you have no right to treat yourself badly. No right. And that's the most important thing to realize. Anytime you catch yourself in negative self-talk or beating yourself up, take out a notebook or your phone and write down what you're saying. Write the exact words, then read them out loud. And again, ask yourself, would you ever say that to a child or to your mother or to a good friend? And if not, then stop saying it to yourself. You owe it to the universe or God or whoever you believe created you to treat yourself nicely. It's not enough just to repeat a positive mantra a few times a day. When you can talk to yourself like you would talk to your own child or another loved one, you will find that your whole life will shift direction. And I'm not talking about now and then. I'm talking about all that repetitive chatter going on in your brain. Use words and tones that you would use with a loved one all the time. Becoming aware of how you speak to yourself is the first step. The second step is actually changing how you speak to yourself. Most people think this is difficult because they've been beating themselves up for so long that it's become a habit. And you can't just get rid of a habit easily because it's a neurological connection in your brain. It's an unconscious loop that repeats itself over and over. And by definition, a habit happens without thinking. It's subconscious behavior. When you wake yourself up and become aware of the habit, you have to make a conscious decision to change it. And to do that, you have to rewire the neurological connections in your brain with new behaviors. It does take effort, but it's completely worth it. The power of gratitude. What helped me get out of the habit of negative self-talk was gratitude. I consciously bring to mind everything I'm grateful for, even the dumbest little things. If I'm writing in my journal, I might notice the pen and think, I'm thankful that I can write. I'm grateful that I can read and convey my thoughts on paper. Oh, look, there's the sky. The clouds are beautiful, and I love how they look against the blue. I'm so grateful that I'm alive, and I can see and appreciate nature's beauty. In addition to running through this exercise whenever you become aware of negative self-talk, you can also pick a time every day to stop and think over the past 24 hours and find 3 to 5 things you're grateful for. And here's the kicker. At first, you're probably not going to feel that grateful. You'll probably feel cheesy at first. You might think, I don't feel grateful. I feel angry at myself, which is why I was giving myself such a hard time about my behavior to begin with. It doesn't matter if you feel it or not. It works anyway. You're suggesting to your subconscious that there's a different pattern it can use, that there's a different way to talk to yourself. You're rewiring your brain to look for the positive in everything, and that changes your habit. Trust that you're making changes in your brain even if you don't feel the results at first. Studies have shown that this simple gratitude exercise can improve your overall happiness in all areas of your life. And I can say that in my experience, that's absolutely been true. But it takes practice and patience, so be nice to yourself, okay? And today, let's do a little writing exercise to help you become aware of your negative self-talk. This is adapted for our purposes from Byron Katie's process of questioning our thinking called The Work, which you can find at thework.com. Let's expose your repetitive stories for what they are and diffuse them in your subconscious. Your feelings are preceded by subconscious beliefs. So whenever you start feeling anxious or bad, you can work backward to uncover the beliefs that are causing the feelings. Once you know the beliefs, you can use the simple strategy below to help let it go. Step 1. Identify that you're not feeling your best and use that as a signal to listen to the voice inside your head. What are you thinking right now? What thoughts are going through your mind? What are the exact words and phrases used? Write them all down. Step 2. Ask yourself, what are the beliefs or stories underlying these thoughts? Step 3. Instead of trying to combat these stories or beliefs directly, be sneaky and ask yourself how they make you feel. Step 4. Look at the situation and ask yourself how you would feel without those thoughts. Imagine how the moment would feel if you couldn't tell yourself these stories or have those beliefs. What if they just disappeared from your mind? How would you feel? What would be different? Here's an example. Step 1. What are you feeling and thinking? You might write, I'm feeling anxious. My chest is tight and I have a sort of tingling running through me. My muscles feel tight. And then these feelings give you pause, so you back up and listen to all the thoughts or self-talk, and you might hear, I'm never going to get ahead at work and I need a beer. Or, my kids are out of control and I can't believe I haven't figured out how to get them to behave. Is it 5 o'clock yet? I can't wait to open that bottle of wine I bought this morning. Or, everyone else seems so much happier than I am. What's wrong with me? I'll pour myself this drink and that will help. Step 2. What stories and beliefs are underlying the thought that you need a drink? For example, I believe a drink would make me feel better right now because I think alcohol will help me relax and deal with the stressors in my life. Or, I want to numb these uncomfortable feelings and I know alcohol can do that. Step 3. How do these stories and beliefs make you feel? Specifically, you might consider how the thought, I need a drink, feels in the context of doing this experiment and the fact that you're not drinking right now. For example, I feel uncomfortable and upset. I feel deprived. I feel weak when I think that I need to have a drink to help me relax. I know the facts say I won't actually relax. I feel like giving in now will actually make me feel worse. Step 4. How would you feel without these thoughts? What if you simply couldn't think that you need a drink? How would you be feeling? It might sound like this. I'm in a challenging situation, and yes, there are difficulties, but they aren't compounded by this sense of struggle over my drinking. Or this. My mind is free to focus on ways to feel better that don't involve alcohol. There's a huge level of stress and anxiety you're building up here because you're feeling this inner conflict of wanting something you've decided that for now you're not going to have. When you become aware of these conflicting emotions, I want a drink, I'm taking a break from drinking, an amazing thing happens. Your subconscious mind identifies these feelings as painful and naturally lets them go. It's like when you're a toddler and an adult says, don't touch that stove, it's hot. At first you don't know what those words mean, so you have to touch it. You have no reason not to. But once you touch the stove and burn yourself, you're never going to touch it on purpose again. It hurts. That lesson becomes deeply ingrained in your subconscious, and you never have to think about not touching a hot stove again. It's the same phenomenon that happens when you simply ask yourself the question, how do I feel when I believe this story? When you believe that you need alcohol to relax, but you're not allowing yourself to drink, or when you believe you need alcohol to have a good time, and you're not allowing yourself to drink, how does that feel? This exercise works because it reveals to your subconscious mind how painful certain stories and beliefs are. Your subconscious says, oh, those feelings are painful, and this miraculous thing happens. Your subconscious mind naturally lets go of the belief because it identifies it as painful. We aren't always aware of our self-talk, and that's why emotions, even the negative ones, are such a gift. Emotions are the signal that something in our thinking is causing stress. Your job is simply to listen to your thoughts, identify the thoughts causing you stress, and question them. If this works for you and you want to know more about this amazing technique, I highly recommend Byron Katie's book, Loving What Is. Day 9, Journal Questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Identify your inner dialogue. Take a minute to think about what you regularly say to yourself and write it down. And if you can't think of anything, wait until the next time you feel anxious or uncomfortable. Use this as a signal to stop and listen to what you're saying inside your head. What are the exact words and phrases you used? 2. Question your inner dialogue. Now that you have a list of things you say to yourself, ask yourself the following questions and write down your responses. Would I say this to someone I love? A child? A friend? Would I even say this to a stranger? How does this make me feel? How does this make me behave? 3. You have the power. This is such an enlightening exercise, and you truly have the power to change how you talk to you. Take a moment to appreciate the awareness you've brought to your inner voice, even if you've realized some of the things you've been saying to yourself are painful, because now you can change them. Write down a list of new things to begin to say to yourself, and make sure you actually believe them. It doesn't do you any good to tell yourself I'm amazing if you don't actually believe it. And then reflect on how it would make you feel and behave if you said these new things to yourself regularly. Day 9 Reflections from the AlcoholExperiment.com. Georgia says, I went out with two girlfriends for dinner last night. We all drank water. There was a moment when we were having a great laugh over something, and I had the best aha moment mid-laugh. I can absolutely have a great time without booze, and I was giddy with happiness over this realization. Slept really well again last night. Rodney says, realizing a belief can cause discomfort and that I can change that simply by asking myself honest questions is so empowering. We don't realize how we're programmed by commercialism and advertising. We want to believe that we know what's best for ourselves, but to realize that some of our habits, thoughts, beliefs, or routines aren't actually even our own ideas, but rather repetitive messages that we take on as fact and live our lives by is very humbling. Taking back our own thoughts, ideas, and beliefs has helped make me feel whole again. And Maria says, I took a couple of sips of wine with dinner tonight and decided that it wasn't good, and I got a flash of what my evenings looked like just a few weeks ago. Too much wine, flushed cheeks, tired, trying not to weave when I get up. I don't think I was actually fooling the hubby. And just falling into bed or falling asleep in front of the TV, zoned out, not connecting. But tonight, I threw the wine down the drain after the first couple of sips. Gone. And it feels great. And I look forward to a good night's sleep and another day tomorrow where I feel rested and relaxed. It's so empowering to think about being AF, alcohol-free. During stressful times at work, this gives me confidence. Act 4. Alcohol, our culture, and society. Awareness. We all have an evolutionary need to fit in with a group. It's a survival mechanism. We even have something called mirror neurons in our brains. If we see someone yawn or stretch or scratch their nose, we're likely to do the same thing. Humans have evolved to fit in with other humans. Think about it. When a prisoner has the harshest punishment inflicted, it's solitary confinement. Being separated from the group is the worst thing we can think of to punish a criminal. So let's name this belief. If I don't drink, I won't be part of the group. So it makes total sense that to fit in with an alcohol-obsessed society, we must be drinkers. But let's break that down so you can decide whether that's something you want to continue. Clarity. It's pretty easy for us to figure out where this belief comes from. We observe evidence of this every single day. Our cultural conditioning practically demands that we drink. We see alcohol all around us, even at church and school functions. Every baby shower, birthday party, wedding, and funeral has some form of alcohol available. All our friends, family members, and authority figures drink. Therefore, we should drink too, just to be considered normal. The same attitude used to be true of cigarettes, do you remember? People smoked because it was just the thing to do. Everyone smoked. Doctors even recommended their favorite brands. That was the reality at one point. Of course, we now know that smoking is dangerous and never should have been encouraged in the first place. And only after many decades of pressure has smoking become denormalized. Now smokers are shunned in restaurants, public buildings, and social events. They're forced to go outside and smoke. Don't think the alcohol industry doesn't know this. It spends billions of dollars each year in the United States alone on advertising to make sure we get the message loud and clear. Cool people drink, funny people drink, sexy people drink. And now, thanks to a new trend in alcohol marketing, fit, healthy people drink. That's right, the newest trend is to associate drinking with good health. Yoga studios have wine tastings. Low-carb beer brands spend millions on Super Bowl commercials with hard-body athletes. And articles circulate on the internet about how this wine or that spirit can prevent everything from cancer to Alzheimer's disease. So according to the media, if you want to be cool, funny, sexy, and fit, you better be a drinker. We've also experienced that feeling of fitting in when we drink with our friends, right? It's fun. We feel cool, at least for a little while, whether we're pounding beers at a baseball game or sipping champagne at a classical music festival. It doesn't matter. When our friends are gathered around us, we're all drinking and having a great time. We fit in. The advertising works so well because it mimics our everyday behavior. Or maybe we behave the way we do because the advertising works so well. Either way, order another round because it's halftime. Never mind the consequences in a few hours or the next morning. Never mind the arguments with your spouse or the lost memories or the raging hangover. You've got to be part of the crowd. So yes, you probably drink to fit in. And yes, it's a cultural phenomenon. Society's view of non-drinkers is that they're boring. They're buzzkills. They aren't any fun to be around. I actually find this hilarious now because I'm still the life of the party, even without a drink in my hand. The truth is that funny people are funny, whether they're drinking or not, and lame people aren't any more interesting just because they're loaded. But the mind is a powerful thing, and since we believe drinkers are more fun, they seem to be, and so we drink, even when we might not want to. And we pressure others to drink, mostly to justify our own choices. When I wrote my first book, This Naked Mind, over 7,000 people volunteered to read it and give me their feedback. I was shocked to hear that so many of them thought that they were alone in their struggle to control alcohol. They all thought that they were the only one struggling. They thought if they questioned how much they were drinking, people would make fun of them or cast them out of their circle of friends. So they kept the problem hidden, often even from themselves. One of the main reasons people say that they can take it or leave it is because they've never actually tried to leave it. Once I was honest about my drinking, suddenly others felt like it was okay to question their drinking too. They worried about the effect on their health and their families, but were too afraid to talk about it. And in the years since I wrote that book, I've discovered that the people who defend drinking the loudest are often the most worried about how much they personally drink. They desperately want to have the same amount of fun while drinking less, but they just don't see how that's possible. The cultural conditioning is that strong. I also want us to ask, what kind of culture are we creating by choosing to be a part of it? Now, it's not popular to talk about, but there's a lot of evidence that an alcohol-saturated culture is actually a culture of violence. According to published studies, in 86% of homicide cases, the perpetrator was drinking at the time of the murder. Or what about domestic violence? 57% of men involved in marital violence were drinking. 75% of cases in which a child died from abuse involved alcohol. There's a hotline in the UK that children can call to have a bedtime story read to them if their parents are too drunk to do it themselves. How heartbreaking is that? As a mother of a new baby girl, I'm horrified to hear the alcohol-related statistics for sexual assault. 60% of sexual offenders were drinking at the time of the offense, and sexual assault is at an all-time high. In fact, if you look at the rise in alcohol consumption and the rise in violent crime, they track each other pretty closely. As drinking rates rise, so do the cultural ramifications. And is that the kind of culture that we truly want to fit into? I know it sounds like I want to wipe alcohol off the planet, but that's not actually the case. What I want is for us as a culture to be more mindful of the consequences and think carefully about what we're choosing to promote as normal. Because you're part of this experiment, you have a unique opportunity to be a mindful observer and just decide for yourself. Consider whether you can enjoy life and have just as much fun with your friends if you're not drinking. Turnaround. The opposite of, if I don't drink, I won't be part of the group, is, if I don't drink, I will be part of the group, or, if I drink, I won't be part of the group. Come up with as many ways as you can that the opposites are as true or truer in your life as the original beliefs. Fitting in during the experiment. You might be worried that if you stop drinking, you'll lose all your friends, even if it's only for this 30-day experiment. This can be especially challenging if you believe you'll be boring without the alcohol. Since you're not making any immediate decisions about the rest of your life, let's talk about how to get through this experiment while keeping your friendships intact. First, don't preach. Nobody wants to hear all your research into the dangers of alcohol. They already know most of it, trust me. And at this point, they don't want to be harassed about it. I became an anti-alcohol evangelist at first, and people actually pitied my husband for having to put up with me. If people ask you about the experiment, give them a brief summary to answer their questions, and maybe point them to this book. Staying low-key will do more good than making them feel like you're judging them. And if they want to make a change with their own drinking, they're probably already judging themselves. Second, be a positive example. Show your friends that you can have just as much fun without drinking and without talking about it all the time. Let them see for themselves that you simply don't want to drink right now, and that's okay. Again, your friends might feel that by not drinking, you're judging their behavior. Even though this isn't true, they may still think it. So don't isolate them. Be as friendly as ever. Let them know you're doing this for you, and don't try to force the idea on them. Third, be creative. You don't have to tell anyone you're not drinking for 30 days. If you're worried about how your friends will react, maybe don't say anything. It's a personal decision, so keep it to yourself for now if you want. There are lots of ways to explain why you might not be drinking on any particular evening. Here are some of my favorites from the community. I can't tonight. I'm driving. I overdid it last night, so I'm taking tonight off. I'm on a detox that doesn't allow alcohol. I'm watching my weight. I'm trying to cut back. I'm doing an alcohol-free challenge. I don't feel like it tonight. I have an important meeting tomorrow, so I want to keep a clear head. If you do decide to continue this 30-day experiment for 60 or 90 days or even indefinitely, you'll eventually want to tell your friends what's going on. And chances are that many of them won't get it. They may not understand, but that doesn't mean that they will stop being friends with you. It can take time, but eventually, most of them will accept your decision. Keep it all about you, not them. This is a change you've made for yourself. And make sure they know that you aren't going to impose your new beliefs on them. Here are some of the phrases that I've used. I realized I'm happier when I'm not drinking. I'm on a health kick, and giving up booze is just part of it. I decided that alcohol was no longer doing me any favors. These days I feel better when I don't drink. I was no longer having fun with alcohol. Also be aware that your own attitudes can affect how others in your group treat you. Notice if you're feeling smug or judging your friends for their alcohol consumption. Examine your own treatment of non-drinkers in the past. Do you have some of the same assumptions that you're afraid people will place on you? You'll also notice the actual reactions you receive from your friends. Your fears may be completely unfounded after all. Your decision to not drink may be a total non-issue. Mindful observation is key to deciding this belief. Can you have as much or more fun and fit in with your friends without alcohol? The answer for me is absolutely yes, and I'm betting you'll come to the same conclusion. But don't take my word for it. Test it out yourself. Day 10, dealing with sugar cravings. Be gentle with yourself. You're doing the best you can. Anonymous. It might surprise you to learn that you may experience heightened sugar cravings during this challenge. This can happen for a couple of reasons. First, most alcoholic drinks contain more than alcohol. In fact, they contain quite a bit of sugar. So your brain is accustomed to the sugar rush from your drink of choice, which will create an intense craving for sugar. Second, both sugar and alcohol create a similar kind of response in the brain. Let's dig into why. When the brain perceives something as being important to survival, it produces a chemical called dopamine in response. Dopamine is also called the learning molecule because it's signaled when the brain wants us to repeat the behavior or learn. It's used for reinforcement. A good example of this is the fact that sex is vital for the survival of the species, and so sex produces high levels of dopamine in the brain. Addictive substances can cause the brain to flood with dopamine. That's true for alcohol and for sugar, which is also addictive. The dopamine is triggered by the substance in this case, rather than by something important for survival. But the flood of dopamine tricks the brain into believing that alcohol is vital for survival. Just think, because of the flood of dopamine, your brain is learning that alcohol is important for your very survival. No wonder it's so addictive. Now, sugar has this same effect. Eating sugar produces huge levels of dopamine. In fact, some studies say that the brain reacts in a similar way to sugar as to substances like cocaine and heroin. And this, again, is in part for survival. Sugar is incredibly calorie dense, and it is an immediate source of energy. If you're trying not to starve, this is a very good thing. However, today, it's not necessary and leads to an overconsumption of sugar. When you take a break from alcohol, the loss of a dopamine response causes the brain to seek out the high levels of dopamine in other forms. And sugar is one of the most readily available substitutes. And finally, you may be accustomed to using alcohol as a treat or a reward. If you say things like, "I had a hard day and I need a drink," or "I need a drink to relax," you're probably associating alcohol with a treat. But since you're not drinking right now, your brain searches for another way to get that same treat or reward. And a very common way to do that is with sugar. So you might think you're craving sugar when what you actually want is a treat or a reward. Maybe a night out with friends or a movie or a massage would give you the same feeling of getting a treat without all the sugar. At first, I made sure to be gentle with myself. Shaming yourself for any behavior from drinking to eating too much sugar is counterproductive to lasting change and self-acceptance. When I stopped drinking, I knew that I was already accomplishing something amazing just by taking a break from booze, and worrying about my sugar intake seemed like a lot to take on at the same time. When I was drinking regularly, I was consuming close to 2 bottles of wine per day. And a bottle of red wine is about 600 to 800 calories. So just by cutting out drinking, I was saving myself over 1,000 calories. For someone who's been drinking that equivalent amount in beer or mixed drinks, the calorie count is much, much higher. I was so happy and proud of myself that I consciously allowed myself to indulge in other areas. I kept gummy bears and fruity candy on hand for those times I needed an extra boost. I didn't feel the need to eat a lot of baked goods or ice cream, so I bypassed those. And something in the math worked in my favor because I still lost 13 pounds in the first 30 days. Now, of course, that's not to say that you will have the same experience. You might lose weight and you might not, but you should feel proud of yourself for sticking with the experiment. Indulging in a little extra sugar worked to keep the alcohol cravings at bay and keep me from feeling deprived. This wasn't a long-term strategy or anything. I never carry gummy bears around with me now, but it was a way in the beginning to treat myself very gently. Allowing the extra sugar worked for me. However, if you don't want to go that route, here are some ways you can keep the sugar cravings at bay. First, elevate your heart rate. Exercise naturally boosts serotonin, the happiness hormone. I highly recommend exercising as much as possible during this challenge to help you purge your system of toxins and reduce the cravings naturally. Exercise also reduces stress and lets you get a handle on your emotions in a healthy way without resorting to alcohol to numb away anything you don't want to deal with. Second, eat fruit when you feel the need for sugar. The fiber in fructose or natural sugar in fruit will keep you satisfied far longer than a piece of candy or other processed sweets would. Third, drink lots of water. When you're thinking about sugar, you're often dehydrated and actually craving water. You can add lemon or lime slices or maybe a bit of stevia, a natural sugar substitute, to give a nice flavor to plain water. Your sweet tooth gets satisfied and you're hydrated as well. Fourth, keep your blood sugar stable. Eating several small meals with protein throughout the day will stabilize your blood sugar. Protein and fat take longer to digest, which helps keep your energy levels even. In addition, protein breaks down into amino acids, which are responsible for a whole host of processes, including healthy brain function. One amino acid that you need to feel good is GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid. When you feel low, it's often because you don't have enough protein in your system to produce amino acids. Alcohol produces GABA in excess, so when you take the alcohol away, you're going to need to replace that amino acid at healthy levels. Eating enough protein will do the job. I've noticed a direct correlation between how much protein I eat and my anxiety levels throughout the day. And eventually, I was able to wean myself off depression medication, which is great, just by eating protein. But eating protein was also a key component to keeping my mood and energy levels stable. Fifth, consume naturally fermented foods and drinks. Wait, fermented? Aren't we trying to get away from fermented drinks? Yes, we are, but these contain such a tiny level of alcohol that they shouldn't cause a problem. And there are so many health benefits to fermented foods. Foods like sauerkraut, kimchi, kefir, and kombucha are fermented naturally and contain live cultures or probiotics. Studies have shown that eating fermented foods is one of the best ways to reduce cravings for sugar and processed foods. But be aware that cooking kills off the good stuff. So canned sauerkraut or processed and sugar-laden yogurt isn't going to work. You need to buy naturally fermented foods that require refrigeration to keep those cultures alive. Baby steps. There's definitely a temptation to do everything at once. You might be thinking, oh, well, I'm taking a break from alcohol, so I might as well quit sugar, start meditating, run 5 miles a day. I'm going to be the very best version of me. And while that's a noble thought, it rarely works that way in the long term. Once you start down the path to self-improvement, it's natural to want to pile on the good habits and become a brand new person. But studies show that this is a recipe for failure. Take baby steps and be gentle with yourself. Focus on this one goal of eliminating alcohol for 30 days, and then you can revisit your other goals next month. Because the beautiful thing is that once you tackle this cornerstone habit and reduce or eliminate your alcohol intake, you'll begin to implement a whole host of other habits, almost by default. I'm now a different person. I exercise regularly, including my weekly Taekwondo practice and my daily mindfulness practice, and I started a business. All these changes stemmed from changing my drinking. I didn't know it at the time, but making that big change caused a positive ripple effect across so many aspects of my life. Today, make a plan for how you're going to tackle sugar cravings when they come up. If you're going to let yourself indulge in sugary foods during the experiment, what choices will you make? Do you have them in your pantry at the moment? And if not, you might want to consider stocking up. If you plan to exercise, what will you do exactly? How can you prevent those cravings from showing up in the first place? Day 10, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Sugar in your experiment. What is your plan for handling sugar cravings? Have you been dealing with this already? Are you planning to let yourself indulge like I did, or will you try to avoid the extra sugar? What alternative choices will you make? Do you have any alternatives in your pantry at the moment? If not, you might want to consider stocking up. 2. Baby steps. Reflect on the concept of baby steps instead of trying to do everything at once. What have you tended toward? Do you try to do it all and then beat yourself up when you don't get it all right? Or are you gentle with yourself, taking baby steps towards your goal? How would you like to be in the future? Day 10 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Lee says, I know I'm one of those people who can overdo it with the self-improvement tasks, so I'm trying to be okay with an imperfect diet that includes some comfort foods while I get through the first 30 days of not drinking and get used to being someone who doesn't drink. Quitting alcohol is hard enough, so I'm choosing to be okay with pasta and dessert for now, as long as I'm also eating more nutrient-dense foods too. Ross says, I found that cutting out drinking has given me more time and energy to put in place healthy habits that have only been thoughts before. I'm being careful to start out slow but consistent. I'm not craving sugar so much as that treat, which has been a bit of a struggle to satisfy. I find that my appetite has increased, so I've started eating smaller meals more often. Also, I'm craving carbs more. Does that have something to do with alcohol? I would expect so. Just being mindful about that too. And yes, gentle is the word for this experiment in every way. Day 11. The alcohol culture is shifting. Don't be afraid of being different. Be afraid of being the same as everyone else. Anonymous. Drinking has become so prevalent, so pervasive in our culture that it's difficult to escape its influence. But there's an amazingly vibrant minority of people who are taking a step back and thinking about that status quo. They've found they're participating in something that isn't much fun anymore, and they're choosing to pause and reflect. And the result is an entire culture shift around alcohol. I first noticed this shift in some of the super athletes and people who are deeply involved in the fitness and health world. They realized that while they were eating all organic food, exercising, and doing yoga, they were also drinking a known toxin and carcinogen in excessive amounts. People are waking up and they're starting to question that behavior. And young people are drinking less. The idea that drinking alcohol might not be such a great idea is becoming more prevalent among young people as well. Young people today are drinking much less than their counterparts were 10 years ago. This change is motivated in part by a desire for better health and to buck their parents' drinking trend. I've heard people say that alcohol is their parents' drug, and so these young people are choosing not to drink. According to a recent poll, 66% of adults under 24 years old in America don't feel that alcohol is important to their life. If you contrast that with older people, the opposite is true. Drinking among older generations, especially women, is going up. In fact, according to a recent study, there was a whopping 107% increase in alcohol use disorder, or AUD, among adults 65 and older, and an 82% increase in AUD among those 45 to 65 years old. So a very intelligent, mindful minority believe that alcohol is less important to their social life than it was to their parents. In fact, the study says that 41% of Gen Y drinkers think that alcohol is less important to their own life than it was to their parents' lives. I believe social media has contributed to this new attitude too. When your entire life is documented on Instagram or Snapchat, you don't want to be caught drunk or passed out. Seeing videos of their friends' behavior can also be a deterrent. And cutting back is a global phenomenon. Drinking less is not only a local phenomenon,